if it gets any higher, you know, than $600 a month, I'm going to get a disconnect notice because I can't pay it.
Anxiety over diminished help to pay high heating bills. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a veterans town hall that seeks to connect vets with civilian life.
Our veterans are coming from a place where they are used to that community and then kind of thrown into the civilian world where they don't necessarily have that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
The team working on the Alaska LNG gas line project is undergoing a shift as the state prepares to take over. At the board of directors meeting today, Frank Richards of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation said staff is winding up preliminary front-end engineering and design. Richards says that means approximately 120 people will be moving on from the project.
So the project management team is demobilizing, so they will be sent back to their parent companies.
The big three North Slope producers, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, indicated earlier this year they would not move forward with the gas line as originally planned. Governor Walker decided the state would take over the project. The state is marketing the project to potential gas buyers overseas, but it hasn't yet decided to move to the next phase of it. Also on the board meeting, AGDC President Keith Meyer said negotiations with the North Slope producers are taking longer than he had hoped. The state aimed to reach an agreement with the companies in October, but Meyer added he felt negotiations are going well and that he doesn't detect anything that's going to stop the process. Natalie Lohman, a spokeswoman for ConocoPhillips, said the companies aim to complete the handover by the end of the year. Richards says once negotiations are complete, the state will begin working to secure a license from the federal government to export liquefied natural gas. A private sector petroleum engineer and consultant will lead the state's oil and gas division. Chantel Walsh of Anchorage will join the Department of Natural Resources at the end of November. She will replace former oil and gas division director Corey Feige, who stepped down in October. Walsh has spent more than 30 years in the private sector in Alaska, working on everything from litigation to drilling design, according to a DNR media release. And that private sector experience isn't common for this position. DNR Deputy Commissioner and Alaska Public Media Board Vice President Mark Wiggin says he's not sure anyone who has headed the oil and gas division has been a professional engineer.
No, it is not common. I believe Chantel has got to have more experience than virtually anybody who's held that position before in the oil industry.
Walsh is leaving the firm she helped found, Petro Technical Resources of Alaska. There, she has consulted on projects for BP, Unocal, and Chevron, according to her resume. She's also the vice chair of the University of Alaska Fairbanks College of Engineering and Mines Advisory Council. A spokesperson for DNR says Walsh is not currently available for interviews. The new House majority will be taking a different approach to legislation next year. That became clear today as the majority named the committee chairpersons who will guide the agenda. For example, House Resources Committee co-chairs Garen Tarr and Andy Josephson are more likely to make further changes to the state's oil and gas tax structure than outgoing co-chairs Benjamin Nagiak and David Talrico. The chairpersons include 11 Democrats and 3 Republicans, a sharp reversal from the current Republican-led majority. The House majority is mostly Democrats for the first time since 1992. Republicans kept control of the Senate, so the change in chairpersons there is less dramatic. House Republicans plan to organize the House Minority Caucus tomorrow. This weekend, the first veteran town hall is to be held in Alaska, is happening in Palmer. The event is part of a growing national movement to better integrate the lives and experiences of veterans with the civilian world. Veterans town halls are nonpartisan opportunities for former service members to speak to an audience for 10 minutes apiece about what it felt like to go to war. Non-veterans are invited to listen. The forum started last year in Massachusetts from an idea by former conflict journalist Sebastian Junger. This year, they're happening in 8 states. Andy Bouchatz is an organizer for Team Red, White, and Blue in Alaska, the veteran support community organizing the town hall.
I hear a lot, I wish I knew how to support our veterans. And I think that we often try to fill that gap by doing something like giving people a 10% discount or saying thank you for your service. Those are great things. But if you knew somebody's story and where they're coming from, you might be better equipped to reach into their lives and to do something that's actually going to impact them.
Bouchatz is also a reporter and editor with the news site military.com, and her husband served in the Army. She says the overall aim of the town halls is to connect vets with nearby members of their community, usually through activities, public service, or exercise.
We believe that people do better in community, that we want to have community and that we need community to really thrive. And our veterans are coming from a place where they are used to that community and then kind of thrown into the civilian world where they don't necessarily have that.
The Veterans Town Hall is at the Palmer Depot this Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. You can find more information about Anchorage's chapter of Team Red, White, and Blue by finding them on Facebook. It could be harder for thousands of Alaskans to stay warm this winter. That's because a state heating assistance program created when oil prices were up has gone away. In the past, the program offered relief for families and individuals who earned too much to qualify for federal heating assistance. Now, some of those households are starting to feel the effects. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
There's a white rectangular box on Diane Buck's wall that's giving her a lot of anxiety.
This is it. That's it.
It controls the heat in her 3-bedroom home that she shares with her boyfriend, his daughter, and his daughter's 3 children. Right now, the thermostat's circular knob is turned to about 60 degrees.
I call it the safe zone, the safe money zone, to get the house at least 69, 70. It'll go up to here. The money zone is what I call it.
And she says that's where a family would feel the most comfortable, at about 69 or 70 degrees. But as Buck suggests, turning the thermostat up to the money zone has consequences. Even coming over here to look at it, she says, fills her with a sense of dread.
It scares me. I really don't like messing with it. That's how afraid I am right now, because if it gets any higher, you know, then $600 a month, I'm screwed. You know, I'm going to get a disconnect notice because I can't pay it.
She says last winter, it wasn't uncommon for her electric bill to climb to $600 a month, her entire disability check. And her boyfriend's income mostly covers the rent. A relative was helping out with some of the expenses last year, but he's moved out. So for the first time, Buck says her family needed the extra help, and she hoped they could rely on a state heating assistance program to stay warm. They were counting on it.
I called them and they said, well, no, we have a new application because of the budget cuts. And that's when I'm thinking, okay, well, we're still qualified, because who in their right mind is going to like do a drastic cut when there's family in need?
The Alaska Heating Assistance Program was created in 2008 when oil prices were high and the cost of heating fuel was too. The application process was the same as its federal cousin, the Low Income Home Energy Heating Assistance Program. But the state version served people above the federal income threshold. In other words, it helped families like Buck's who were on the bubble.
I printed out the application. I had it all filled out.
When the price of North Slope crude was soaring, those funds even carried over to the federal program. There was more heating assistance overall. But the state program didn't make it through cuts to this year's budget.
I could probably heat this house with 2 candles if I had to.
Fred Berg is also on the Alaska Heating Assistance Program. He's a former state worker on Social Security disability, and he still qualifies for some federal heating assistance. But he says it's about $500 less than what he received before. Still, he thinks he'll be able to make it through this winter. In his words, his financial situation isn't in dire straits, and he understands why the program was cut. but he wishes he would have known more before this November.
It's a delicate subject, you know. You get your hopes up, all right, I might get subsidized a little bit for this, that'll help. And then they turn around and slap you in the face, oh no, I'm going to give you nothing.
The state did send out a letter this summer warning past recipients about the cuts. And besides the declining oil revenue, the state says another reason it's doing away with the program is there just wasn't enough need. But Diane Buck doesn't agree. She says her family could have really used the help.
I mean, it's sad. We actually have to wrap up in blankets. What am I supposed to do? I can't even provide enough electricity. Because if I did, then it would be over 600.
For now, Buck says it's about keeping the thermostat out of the money zone. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, disagreement over the value of body cameras for Juneau police.
And it has the potential for costing the city far more for having the body cameras than not having the body cameras.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The University of Alaska has decided not to cut six sports teams. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, UA President Jim Johnson today rescinded an earlier cost-saving recommendation that men's and women's ski teams at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and ski and indoor track programs at the University of Alaska Anchorage be eliminated.
Cutting the teams would have saved a projected $1.1 million, but dropped both UAF and UAA below an NCAA 10-team minimum, and both schools had requested waivers to do so. University President Jim Johnson told the Board of Regents meeting in Fairbanks Thursday that the universities were informed Wednesday that the NCAA declined to rule on the waiver requests.
They said basically, if you want to go below 10 teams, go for it. Then ask for permission after the fact. In my view, however, this approach contains way too much risk, financial risk, but more importantly, potential sanctions to both of our entire athletic programs.
The university will also not pursue an alternative waiver-dependent proposal to merge UAF and UAA athletic programs as a way to drop below the NCAA team minimum. Johnson told Regents he's no longer recommending cutting sports.
And I think that change of mind is supported by the impressive outpouring of support by the athletics community in general and by the Nordic ski community in particular.
Johnson says he's instead recommending Regents work with communities to increase private funding for sports programs. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Juneau Police Department plans to outfit 40 of its officers with body cameras to improve evidence gathering, transparency, and accountability. The department will have the money to buy those cameras after the Juneau Assembly on Monday approved about $19,000 toward a U.S. Department of Justice matching grant that totals nearly $52,000. However, Juneau Mayor Ken Kelsch and Deputy Mayor Jerry Nankervis oppose the appropriation in the 7-2 vote. Nankervis is a retired Juneau Police Department captain.
I have a suspicion that not all of the legality of the body cameras has been worked out yet, and it has the potential for costing the city far more for having the body cameras than not having the body cameras.
Nankervis was skeptical the cameras would reduce unfounded grievances. He alluded to the Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation's lawsuit against the city of Kodiak about the release of audio and video recordings showing three local police officers roughing up a man with autism. Those recordings were eventually released. Juneau Police Chief Bryce Johnson said whatever recordings may show in incidents like that, the public and police are better off with them.
It's good if the police did it right. It's good for the public to know we did it right. And if we did it wrong, we need to own that and fix it. And it's good for the public to know when we do it wrong that we admit to our mistakes and we make them better.
Nankervis also said he had concerns about body cameras infringing on privacy. Johnson said to the extent that police infringe on privacy, they're already doing it with their eyes and notes. He said cameras just create a more accurate record.
My firm professional opinion is the benefit we get out of them far outweighs the potential problems that they may come back and bring us.
Nankerva said cameras and recordings create an expectation that everything is recorded, and conversely, when something isn't, it reduces the chance of prosecution and could create suspicion that authorities have tampered with the recordings. Mayor Kelsch, who participated by phone, did not speak about his no vote. Juneau's first legal retail marijuana sales could begin by month's end. James Barrett co-owns Rainforest Farms, and no other business in Juneau has cleared as many of the regulatory hurdles to legally grow and sell pot.
We have a couple inspections next week, and right now we're harvesting our first crop. So if all goes well, then we'll be opening Black Friday.
At least 10 other ventures have sought state licenses in Juneau for one or more aspects of the marijuana business. Separate licenses are required for growing, processing, retailing, and testing. Southeast Alaska Laboratories is the first testing facility in Juneau to get a state license. Jessica Drybalbus is manager and part owner. Monday night, the Juneau Assembly waived its right to protest her state testing license. She says she's got some technical inspections and certifications to get through, but that her lab could be up and running by December 1st. Moving marijuana through regular options out of town runs afoul of federal law. Barrett is tight-lipped about how his crop will make it to store shelves without a local lab.
I can't really make a comment on our testing for our products, but they will be tested.
Drybalbus said licensees need clean criminal records, and moving marijuana in and out of town for testing could put those licenses at risk. Paul Dreisdyer is majority owner of Fireweed Factory, likely the next closest marijuana business to open in Juneau. His business has a land use permitting application going before the Juneau Planning Commission at the end of the month for a tiny 158 square foot storefront on Front Street.
It'll be the smallest marijuana retail store in Alaska, I'm sure. But there's one that I know of in Washington that's even smaller, so it doesn't take much space.
He says he's aiming for retail sales beginning around February or March. It's too early to know what sort of economic impact the new marijuana businesses will have. City finance officials have estimated the 8% sales tax on marijuana will raise between $170,000 and $455,000 per year. A hearing on Tuesday in Fairbanks Superior Court postponed the trial date for the four men accused of the killing of John Kerverluk, Jr. The trial was scheduled to begin next week, but now is set to begin on January 23rd. Kerverluk was shot and killed outside of the Rock and Rodeo Bar on the old Stees Highway in Fairbanks in May of 2015. Four suspects fled the scene and then scattered across the country. While Fairbanks police have since identified all four of those suspects, only three are currently in custody. That includes the man who allegedly pulled the trigger that night, Patrick Dale Burton Hill. Fairbanks police assisted in the arrest of Burton Hill in Cleveland, Ohio, but he remains in custody there, where he is also a suspect in an unrelated incident. Patrick's brother, Calvin Dale Burton, has been charged and indicted for his involvement in the incident, but is still at large. Two other suspects are being held at the Fairbanks Correctional Facility.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The municipality of Anchorage has launched a new online application to help ease Alaska commutes and encourage alternative forms of transportation. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Brendan Babb is the municipality's chief innovation officer and one of the driving forces behind the city's new trip planner, Link AK.
This app has a lot of potential for carpooling. You can find other people that live close to you that are trying to go to the similar locations and hopefully identify carpools, also identify van pools. Since we're trying to find out where people are trying to go, it helps us figure out, would a van pool or something else be helpful to get people from point A to point B.
It's not only limited to cars and vans. The site accounts for biking, walking, and even public transit. The service is simple enough to use. Type in your starting point in one box and your destination in the other. Once you click go, it takes users to an interactive map where they can select their preferred mode of transportation and find both illustrated and written travel instructions. Babb says the site also shows users the distance, estimated travel time, and calories burned.
And also see how much greenhouse gases you divert.
For example, biking the 4.4 miles between the University of Alaska Anchorage and the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center would take about 25 minutes, burn 246 calories, and emit no greenhouse gas. Babb expects the app to keep expanding to include additional transportation options.
We're talking to taxi companies to see if we can add information in, and if a ride-sharing like Uber or Lyft came back here, it'd be really easy to integrate that as well.
And Babb says he also wants Link AK to become a statewide service.
My goal is at some point you'll be able to go from Talkeetna all the way to Girdwood and figure out what trip to take.
Currently, the service is available in Anchorage, the Matanuska and Susitna Valleys, and Sitka. Link AK's development was paid for with federal grant money, and upkeep is estimated at about $70,000 per year, with the first 3 years paid for through the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions Transportation Improvement Plan Fund. Link AK is mobile and desktop computer friendly and can be found at linkak.org. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
10 top-level U.S. and Canadian commissioned and non-commissioned officers toured the Army's Black Rapids training site on Tuesday. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the event was part of an ongoing series of meetings intended to enable commanders of the two militaries to operate jointly in the far north.
Despite growing tensions between the U.S. and Russia around the world, Air Force Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach says the Arctic, for the most part, is a conflict-free zone.
We want to maintain the Arctic as a peaceful place as it's been for a while. And if anyone was to challenge us in the Arctic, we've got to be ready to meet that challenge.
To help keep the peace, senior commanders of the U.S. and Canadian military and Coast Guard units that operate in the far north this week held another in a series of semi-annual meetings in Alaska to get to know their counterparts and capabilities of the units they command. Wilsbach says the sessions enable commanders to exchange ideas on training and operating in the vast, empty, and frigid expanses on land and at sea around North America's Arctic.
And so it's a defensive mission that is very difficult to accomplish because of the size of the region as well as the environment.
Wilsbach heads up the Alaskan Command, headquartered at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. He says the meetings like those held Monday through Wednesday now include sessions that place greater emphasis on responding to disasters. Operations Wilsbach expects will become more frequent as the warming climate melts sea ice and opens up shipping lanes around the Arctic.
That is the most likely thing that we'll be asked to do in the near future.
Perfect example, the Crystal Serenity, cruise ship that sailed all the way across from Alaska through the Northwest Passage into New York.
Canadian Forces Brigadier General Pat LaRoche serves as liaison and deputy for Wilsbach in his capacity as head of the North American Air Defense Command's Alaska region.
So what if something happens with that ship along the way? Who's going to be called to rescue these folks, right?
That was the scenario behind an exercise held in September that challenged military and civilian emergency responders to evacuate passengers from a cruise ship that had run into trouble in the Bering Strait. The exercise was held just as a real cruise ship, the Crystal Serenity, was sailing through the area and on to the Northwest Passage en route to New York City with 1,700 people aboard.
There's a lot of tourism in the Arctic, so that's an issue.
LaRoche says the Canadian and U.S. militaries also are called to respond to natural disasters, such as wildfires, earthquakes, and volcanoes.
We have to be ready across the whole spectrum.
Wilsbach, who also serves as 11th Air Force Commander, hosted this round of the so-called General Officer Flag Officer Summit. It included a tour of the Black Rapids training site about 30 miles south of Fort Greely, where the generals spoke with media. An Alaskan command spokesman says the next summit meeting, scheduled for March, will be held for the first time in Canada at Yellowknife, the capital of the Northwest Territories. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Five Mount Edgecombe students took part in a filmmaking class last year and will showcase their work at a screening in Sitka tonight. The films focus on place, culture, and climate change in a handful of villages across the state. KCAW's Emily Russell sat down with one of the film instructors and has the story.
Emmett Williams has been in the film industry for decades. His work has taken him to Africa and South America and to big cities like New York and London. Most recently, though, Sitka has been the focus of his storytelling.
So when I came to Sitka, I met Peter Bradley at the Island Institute, and we became not only good friends, but we had a lot of creative ideas that were similar.
One of those ideas involved students at Mount Edgecombe. The Island Institute, a Sitka-based nonprofit, was looking to start a storytelling program at the school. Williams, on the other hand, wanted to teach students about the more technical aspects of filmmaking.
I was having a conversation about that with Annika Orr, the program manager of the Island Institute at the time, and we said we should do it together. And so Annika and I started working together, and it's been an amazing partnership.
That partnership resulted in a class at Mount Edgecombe. With a $20,000 grant from the Crosset Fund, the Island Institute paid Williams and Ord and purchased 8 high-quality audio and video kits for the students to use. Williams says in the beginning, students learn the basics of storytelling and documentary filmmaking.
And so we also said, you know, these are examples of climate change stories. These are examples of stories about culture. These are examples of stories about place. And then we said, forget all that. What do you care about?
Williams says it was important to let the students decide what each of their stories would be about. Once they had the basic training, they each went home for the summer with film equipment in hand and an idea in mind.
The 5 stories are based in Craig, Bethel, Nustayahook, Klawak, and Old Harbor.
And their stories ended up being just as diverse as the places where they were filmed. Williams is careful not to give anything away, but what he will say is how impressed he is with each of the students.
You know, when you work with teenagers or kids, sometimes you think, you know, whatever they come back with will be happy. I'm just happy that they came back with something. But we were literally in shock at how amazing the footage and the interviews are.
And Williams has no doubt moviegoers will be just as shocked at the amazing footage as he is. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Josh Edge, Zachariah Hughes, and Andrew Kitchenman in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney, Jeremy Shea, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Emily Russell in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.